from her perspective is that she wants to wait until it's in use before looking at it harder. I am completely open to if UAS is concerned about the looking at what the process offers without having seen it, you know, before it actually gets used, if we want to do a comparison of the grievance process versus the review process and look at that. I know it's come up several times at our meetings and people are concerned about it. I think it would be perfectly appropriate to look at it here first and then take any findings or resolutions on that item up through Staff Alliance. But I think the sense I've got from Staff Alliance is that until it's been used, that committee probably won't do much more effort on it. They don't see it as urgent. So I'll just open that up for comments or discussion.
I think waiting until it's used is like waiting until there's a car accident to fix a problem with an intersection. And I don't know that it's really a super horrible process, but I don't think it's a good precedent. And I think we should keep pushing at least to find out more about what it's actually going to mean. Do we have any idea how many layoffs there have been?
I think we probably do. We'd have to talk to HR. I think sometimes it's a tricky number to pin down because a lot of times someone will receive a layoff notice in one department. They go on the layoff list and are rehired. So I think the number of people who have received a layoff notice and then have actually left the university is maybe half as many as have received a layoff notice period, at least at UAS. I think, do you remember the number? The chancellor gave us a number in the spring. I think it was like 19, something like that, of which 10 had been rehired.
You know, looking into the actual process of what this grievance process is supposed to look like and being familiar with that is definitely important for us because the preliminary things, like verbiage of what the process is supposed to do seems to me like it's a lot of the process keeping control of the head now. And I agree, I don't think we should wait for there to be a issue to look into it.
Do you think would you feel comfortable taking this on with staff affairs? It seems like a good staff affairs issue to me, or you could even have a subcommittee within staff affairs and other people could join in. But what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think, part of what we were sort of waiting on was what the Staff Alliance Committee was doing, or what the Staff Alliance is doing. And so, you know, now that they've kind of backed off from that, I think we could go ahead and take that in and see how far we want to go.
Great. So anyone who's not on staff affairs, if you feel strongly about this issue or want to know more about it, I would just encourage you to get in touch with the staff affairs committee and be involved. You could definitely just be involved if you're already on another committee. You can be involved on a by-issue basis as well. We've done that before, so great. And actually, we might, Nicole, as an action item, just send a note out after the meeting as well, because I think Jesse was at least one who's not here today who I think was really interested in this topic, just so that anyone who missed that piece knows that staff affairs will be taking this on and people can join in as needed.
Chris, you have a question.
Yes, sir. I'd like some clarification on how people that are going to be laid off are notified and what kind of documentation do they receive. Do they have a full rundown of the options, including the review process and grievance process that occurs?
I have no idea. So that would be a good thing to for that committee to look at as well. Maybe as kind of I would suggest having kind of a background fit first. What is the layoff process? What's involved there? And then, you know, with the review versus the grievance.
I really hate to see the fact that there hasn't been any use of this process simply because no one knows this. Or, I mean, I think it went out of a communicator at one point, but, that's not something that I probably remember over time. So we should take a close look at that.
From what I recall of this discussion, laid off employees are supposed to be given notice within a certain amount of time. I think it's 4 weeks for non-exempt, and is it 3 months now for exempt? And so there is supposed to be that formal notice, but I don't know if we've ever asked if that formal notice includes information about the grievance process, or the review process, or if it includes the rehire rights information. I think it's supposed to include that information, but I don't know if we've ever asked about the review process specifically.
All right, thank you.
Okay, so let's move on for now, and then I am looking forward to hearing more from Staff Affairs about that at our next meeting, if that's all right with everyone. The volunteer day proposal.
Sure. So the status of this, status of the volunteer day proposal is that the chancellor plans to convene a committee to discuss it. I'm conscious that that's been the status update the last two or three meetings. But we did discuss it with Chancellor Powers at pre-staff. Yeah, I would also observe that the idea for a volunteer day has come up a few times, sort of informally. I've heard him mention it at the last couple of pre-staff meetings that we've had with him, in addition to the town hall, the Title IX town hall forum two or three weeks ago. He brought it up as a the way that I hesitate to mention a lot of this just because there haven't really been any official discussions. The committee has not yet been formed. We haven't met yet. Chancellor's cabinet is meeting today, and Chancellor Powers indicated to us that that would be where he would attempt again to form a group of people to discuss it with our involvement, with staff counsel's involvement. So I hesitate to say a lot about the way that he's mentioned it, but he did say publicly at that Title IX forum that he was thinking about it in addition to an opportunity for staff to volunteer within the community, within the Fairbanks and the campus communities, also as maybe an opportunity to take voluntary training, to participate in campus aesthetic beautification projects. So I'm conscious that represents a little bit of a shift in the way that advocacy committee and staff council described volunteer day and described the idea initially. I think that on the one hand, I'm open to leaving to having a wide breadth of options and choices for folks, but I'm also that wasn't really the motivation behind the idea and the proposal in the first place, and that's not how it's described in the proposal that Chancellor Rogers signed. So I don't want to get too far ahead of things. Again, there will be a committee, there will be official discussions, the Chancellor will be involved, his cabinet members will be involved, and so will we. But I just wanted to update folks about how the administration is kind of been discussing it and mentioning it and thinking about it currently. I mean, a lot of the concerns that we've heard, Faye and I met, I guess it's a couple months ago now, with the cabinet to bring the idea forward to them. A lot of their concerns that day and a lot of the concerns that we've heard from folks since then have been pretty similar, I think, to the ones raised and the anxieties raised about this idea initially here, both in committee and on staff council. So we acknowledge that that there are questions, that there are legitimate questions about how the proposal, how the idea is implemented, but those aren't surprises. And I think that the way that we frame it, once that committee is formed and gets going, will make a lot of difference in terms of its success. Yeah. But I would certainly answer any questions or try to if people have them here today. Like I said, today is the Chancellor's Cabinet meeting, and I anticipate having clearer information and a clearer timeline and plan by the end of the day, I hope. That's all.
All right. Moving on quickly, because our guest speaker has arrived, we did electronically pass that resolution in support of the transformation team report. Thank you guys for your initial feedback provided. Huge thanks to Nate for crafting that. I was out of town. So it was passed and submitted. It's attached here. I think that, it spoke to the general spirit of the team's mission and report. And I think that it addressed a lot of the concerns that we saw come through the forum, particularly about the idea of resourcing if work gets passed to UAS staff to take on instead of happening at statewide. Resources need to come with that. It can't be just more work without any extra support to make that happen. So I think they are focused, and I've heard from the team, they're very much looking at not just doing a shift of things or a lift and shift, not tossing stuff over the fence, but really thinking about not just from a cost perspective, but does it make sense for these things to be done centrally? If it doesn't, can they be done at the university? If so, what resources would it take to do it well there and then compare? So the next steps on that, sorry, can you guys hear me okay on the phone or on the Hangout still? Okay. Thank you. The next steps on that, there will be probably 5 to 7 committees, subcommittees come out of that to look at different areas. So one might be administration, one might be IT. I'm not sure what some of the other, probably an HR one. And the team that put together this report will serve as a steering committee. So the president is expecting these committees to have to meet for a total of 3 days over the next few months, spread out, do some real kind of deep dives into the recommendations. The goal of the teams is not to counter the recommendations. It's to see if we implemented this and how, what would the impacts be and what would the effect be. And they'll be working through those items back through the steering committee and then presenting to the president in March. He will work then with his leadership team so that he can make any decisions by April, which gives about 3 months for implementation time with a goal of having changes in place by the start of the new fiscal year. We've said, and I believe it's been heard from the system level, that we do want more governance involvement in the teams, not just providing feedback at the end, but actively working on the teams. Tom Langdon, the statewide administrative assembly president, who was formerly a UAS staff council rep, he's now the SAA president, he did a completely fantastic job. I heard huge kudos to him from the president and from the transformation team with some of the listening sessions he did, and provided very detailed, clear feedback in a very professional manner. So that could actually have been under staff achievements and highlights, but he really, there wasn't a role for governance prescribed there until the end review, and he took it on anyway and did a really detailed and fantastic job. So I fully expect he'll be involved going forward as well. So we'll just be looking to see those teams as they're announced.
Okay.
Yep.
Is there going to be, other than staff governance or faculty governance, is there going to be representation from the universities on those teams, not just statewide people? Because I know there's a lot of people with expertise in those areas who ought to be involved.
Yeah, I think the same as the statewide transformation team itself was made up of two reps from each of the universities and statewide, I expect that the committees will similarly be made up of a, you know, each team should have people from each university at it. All right. I don't see anyone in the room for public comment. Do we have anyone online? All right. Jeez, if you wouldn't mind. Thank you. So our guest today is Police Chief Keith Mallard, who is also the chair of the UAF Green Dot Program. And given the recent discussions about sexual assault and misconduct at UAF and the administration's response, we've heard a lot from the chancellor about wanting to have a cultural change or a culture of safety and support and taking care of each other and taking care of our students. So we've invited Chief Mallard to come talk about the Green Dot program and kind of what that means and how staff can be involved.
Okay. Good morning, everybody. Can everybody hear me okay? So for those that haven't heard about the Green Dot program, it's a really interactive training that equips its participants with the knowledge and skill to recognize when, in particular, when those early signs where power-based interpersonal violence is occurring. When we talk about power-based interpersonal violence, we're talking about domestic violence, dating violence, sexual assault, stalking, those types of behaviors. It's a similar list that you may have seen or heard as they talked about those additional crimes that are included under Title IX after 2011's Dear Colleague letter. And that's where I think it fits with what the chancellor's trying to do. I could talk more about it, but in a nutshell, what the Green Dot program is about, it takes the visualization of a map, and we oftentimes track epidemics with red dots. So whether it's the zombie apocalypse or the spread of real life spread of disease, each one of those red dots represents an occurrence of the event that you're tracking. So, and we've all seen the movies where you have, the smart scientist guy up in front of a group of decision makers articulating that if we don't do anything, this is what's going to happen. And lo and behold, the red dots spread, they multiply, and before you know it, the entire map is covered with red. In the Green Dot program, we use the same visualization. But instead of a zombie apocalypse or spread of disease, the red dots represent that moment in time where somebody makes the decision, the choice, to hurt somebody else, whether it's through their words, through their actions, a push, a hit, having sex with somebody without their consent. Those moments in time are red dots. The basic principle of the green dot is that in many of these situations, when these things occur, they very rarely occur in a vacuum. There always seems to be people around. So if you stick with me for just a second to illustrate this, picture in your mind's eye somebody that's really important to you. It could be your mom, your dad, one of your kids. Perhaps it's your wife, your husband, but somebody you really care about. And at the same time, and we're not going to stay here long, but at the same time, they're in a situation where somebody's trying to hurt them. In that same situation, there's somebody there that could stop what's going on. But they choose not to. For lots of reasons, they choose not to get involved. How does that make you feel? I mean, for me, it makes me feel frustrated, a little angry, and I would imagine it's probably the same for all of you. the fact of the matter is that's the reality. That's more than just a visualization exercise. That's the reality of our society is oftentimes those signs are there, signals are there, those red flags are there, whatever metaphor you want to use, and people choose not to get involved for lots of reasons. They choose not to get involved. So what we talk about in the Green Dot program is we talk about equipping the participants with, one, recognizing when that risky event, that bad thing's happening or about to happen, and arming them with choices, options, if you will. The way that we talk about these things, and as we're talking about getting involved, we use the illustration of the green dot. That's where it comes in, as opposed to the red dot. So the green dot is that moment in time where somebody sees something happening and they choose to do something. So they choose to get involved. So as we're talking about green dots, we really break them into two types of green dots. There's the reactive, and that's what we've been talking about. You see something, you do something. And then the proactive. The reactive we break into three groups that we call the three Ds. That's direct, delegate, and distract. So when we're talking about the direct, I think that's where most of us think of, well, that's how the only way you get involved is you directly get involved. The delegate is for whatever reason you don't feel safe getting involved or you don't feel comfortable getting involved, so you delegate it to somebody else. So you call, in the student's case, maybe you talk to an RA or RD. Maybe you talk to, you know, in y'all's cases, a supervisor or a coworker, or call the police, or, I mean, that you're basically delegating the responsibility to somebody else that perhaps feels comfortable getting involved. And then distract, which is really the most creative of the three. We talk about options on how to get involved in such a way that it's non-confrontational. An example that I frequently use is a real-life example that one of the participants shared with me after going through the Green Dot program. She and some of her friends were out in a local establishment having a good time, and there was a group of guys that were hitting on them pretty hard, and they weren't getting the message that they weren't interested. So the participant also was the designated driver, but she started acting like she had had too much to drink. So much so that she went over to one of the guys and put her hand on his shoulder and started to act like she was going to throw up. As you can imagine, that created some distance, right? Her friends then said, well, let's check on you. And they grabbed their stuff. They went to the bathroom, said, hey, you want to get out of here? And boom, they were out of here. Non-confrontational, nothing happened. They were feeling uncomfortable, but it allowed them some options. It reminded them that there's options other than making a scene, making a big deal of it. Because there's not many of us that are comfortable with doing that, you know. So another example might be you're in the Fred Meyers as often we find ourselves. And a mom and a child, or the mom's getting kind of angry, starting to get frustrated. You can see it starting to escalate. Just going up and asking, do you know where the tomato soup is? Simple things like that. Not saying, hey, you need to chill out because you're getting angry, because we know that all works on us, right? But just creating that space, that's what really the distractions are about. And then the other group is the proactive. And really, that's what's going to change our culture. Because for decades and decades and decades, there's those of us that have been reactive to these situations. But when we talk about the proactive, what we're talking about is we're talking about communicating clear messages that if a new person, whether it be staff, faculty, or student, comes to UAF, they understand two cultural norms here. The first one is that power-based interpersonal violence is not okay here on campus. And the second thing is that we expect, as part of our UAF community, that everybody does their part to prevent it from happening. The reality is we all have what within the Green Dot program we call barriers, but those things that prevent us from acting when our gut's telling us that we probably should. And the idea is if the more people that we get involved saying, I will try and do something, when I fall on my face and don't act, one of you is going to. And so that's when we start seeing the culture shift. And, you know, anytime I talk about culture change or culture shift, occasionally you'll see the people's eyes start to glaze over. And the reality is it seems like this big nebulous thing, right? But it's culture, our culture changes all the time. Whether it's clothing styles or Facebook, right? I mean, many of us grew up in a world where Facebook didn't exist, right? And now it's everywhere to the point that billions of people are communicating with one another on Facebook. Well, that's a social change. And all it came down to is individuals making a choice to take 2 minutes and create a Facebook page, which is different than they did the day before. So you equate that to what we're talking about here, and it's just individuals making a choice to do something different today than they did yesterday. Instead of looking the other way, finding that thing that they're comfortable with, but getting involved, whether it's direct intervention, delegating the authority, or a distract. So that's kind of it in a nutshell. Specific to staff and faculty, because really a lot of the training is aimed at students. But in order to change the culture here, I believe that we can't just focus on the students. I believe that we, as staff in particular, but also faculty, we are the support, if you will, that allows that culture change to happen. And so, we either reinforce it or we kind of push back against it. I mean, it just is what it is. Our influence, our peer influence, those groups that we have influence over, we're always influencing them. So we're either reinforcing that it's okay for this to go on by not saying anything, or we're saying, hey, this is a big deal because we're talking about it. And so where we come in is basically communicating those things like violence is not okay here at UAF, and we expect everybody to do their part. So is there any questions? Because I can really rattle on for a long time on this. So, yes, ma'am.
So I really appreciate this explanation of Green Dot, what that means. All the time that I've heard about Green Dot, I never knew what that meant, and that's really awesome. And I realize now that there's been a few times in my life when I've been the Green Dot or done the Green Dot or however what the verbiage is. But there was one event a couple years ago up here that I didn't know what to do. I didn't do anything. And I still have puzzled over what was the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. This was before the Title IX training, but even then, so I was in the 24-hour study area on the weekend working on my own stuff, and I saw some students come in to do a study. They were a study group, and there was a man in the group who was closer to 30. Everyone else in the class was typical, more traditional ages, you know, around 18. And from where I was sitting, I could see under the table, and the girl sitting next to him looked like she was probably 17. And he just kept poking her in the side and kind of doing little flirtatious things. And I thought, she didn't look like she was welcoming it, but at the same time, you know, he was the head of their study team. Mm-hmm. And I was just so torn. I was like, what do I do here? I don't know who they are. I don't have any names. I don't know for sure that it is unwelcome. But at the same time, you know, putting myself in that girl's shoes, you want to get a good grade, you want to be part of your team. What do you do when there's a strong person leading like that? In the workplace, that would be considered unprofessional and making it a hostile work environment. But in this setting, I don't know what that is, and I don't know what you should do.
So in the training, we kind of go through those kind of things because there really is no right or wrong answer. It's about rather than doing nothing, doing something, right? So we also talk about normalizing the check-in. Here in Fairbanks, if you break down on the side of the road, especially in winter like this, 9 out of 10 cars are going to stop on it, right, just to see if you're okay. So that's already part of our Fairbanks culture. So how do we bring that idea into the situation you're talking about? It could simply be, so say, hey, everything all right? given the opportunity, right? Depending on how you, in your case, you didn't know anybody in that group. So maybe talking to somebody at the library or calling the police, you know, or talking to an RA or figuring out what class they were in and maybe talking to the teacher about what you saw or, you know, there's lots and lots of options, all of which would be okay. And as you pointed out, what you didn't know is that whether or not it was welcome behavior versus unwelcome behavior. That's where normalizing that check-in comes in. Because it doesn't have to be confrontational, right? You're just making sure everything's okay, right? And perhaps you go up to the girl and say, you know, I'm unfamiliar with this Dewey Decimal System. Could you help me find a book, right? And you get her away from there and then say, hey, is everything all right? I noticed he's poking you. You okay with that? You need my help? That sort of thing. But there's lots of options, and it's about you as an individual identifying those options that you're comfortable with and then making that commitment to yourself to act versus not to act so that we don't have to wrestle. I mean, it's clearly something important to you because it automatically came to your head, right? So we don't have to wrestle with those things. But also it establishes, I believe, it'll help establish that cultural norm that we're talking about. Violence is not okay, and everybody's expected to do their own part. So.
Thank you. So we have two questions online. Let me just take those before we go back to the room. And I think they're sort of related. So one is from Jane, how does someone who wants to help get involved with this? And then from Jessica, is this training, the Green Dot training, offered to staff or will it be?
So two great questions that I absolutely love to hear. So I will answer the training available question first. So in the violence prevention strategy, the curriculum, their recommendation is that the training be 6 hours. We've been, here at UAF, we've been able to narrow that down to a very busy 4 hours. We've offered that 4-hour training to admissions and registrar. They had actually approached us and said, hey, we want to be part of this, and we want you to try out staff and faculty training on us. What we did with admissions and registrar is we broke the 4 hours into two-hour sessions. And this week we'll finish our last group of them, and they'll be completely trained. So there is that opportunity. The other thing that we're working on right now is we're working on, because 4 hours is a huge commitment of time, we're working on condensing the training specific for staff and faculty down to about 90 minutes. And in that 90 minutes, we would give kind of an overview of what Green Dot is, but also we would talk specifically about how staff and faculty, specifically, as I said 3 or 4 times now, can support the program in itself, the change on culture, and then give staff and faculty opportunity for those that want to explore it further. But that way, that hour and a half, we can train more people quicker. And then for those that have a particular interest to explore it further, we can provide those options as well. The other opportunity for somebody that really wants to get involved is right now we have 3 trainers that are doing all this training. It's myself, Ronnie Houchin, who's in, he's the director of student, I always mess up the title, but basically new orientation and student transitions. And then Kim Swisher, who's faculty here at UAS. So the 3 of us are currently the 3 trainers, and we need to expand that training pool. So what we've been able to do is contract with the Green Dot Company, and they're coming up here in February to provide train-the-trainer training. If you are interested in being one of those trainers, the idea would be if we have a large enough cadre of trainers that instead of 3 people doing all the trainings, you might have to do 1 or 2 a year, and we can spread it out evenly that way. So that's kind of the idea if you're interested. And then the so it was that question, and then what was the first question again?
Oh, it was about how to get involved.
Oh, okay. So I guess I answered them both.
Yeah. And there was a note from Jane as well, who's in the Office of Admissions and the Registrar, who said they loved the training that you guys have provided so far.
That is great news. So, as I started with, it's very interactive. It's not death by PowerPoint by any means. You're up. You're talking with each other. It's really about identifying your own place in this, meeting you where you're at. In my own experience, all too often as somebody that certainly was passionate about this, but we really labeled people and we put them in categories and we limited their ability to be effective as we're trying to change these just epidemic trends. And so all we were doing is saying, hey, this is bad, but not really providing people with the tools to be action-oriented. So that's what I think is different about Green Dot than anything else that I've participated in. You had a question.
We covered it.
Oh.
Brad, did you?
You mentioned that we're working on condensing that training into a 90-minute training. Is there a timeline for that? When should general staff, faculty, other university members be able to say, I want to sign up for this?
So we're really close. Right now, so we're done with the condensing the curriculum, and we put it into PowerPoint slides, mainly to guide people like me that can go on forever, so we can keep it to 90 minutes. And right now, we're kind of spreading it to people to take a look at, in particularly faculty and staff, to say, this is meaningful, this isn't. Once we get their feedback back, the idea is that we will incorporate the ideas, and then hopefully by January, February, we'll be able to offer those trainings to staff and faculty.
Okay, thank you.
So on that note, I would like to offer up staff council as a ready group to provide feedback or to take a test version of the training. I think we have a lot of staff who are passionate about this. So if that is something that would be useful
absolutely.
To the development, then Nicole or whoever I could set that up.
Okay. So. Yeah, we'll make that happen. We always love the guinea pigs. So, and we really do appreciate the feedback because our time is precious, and so we want it to be meaningful, the time that you spend in the training.
And then one other note from me before I go back. I think this would also be a really great training to have offered at the annual Staff Development Day in May. When there are a lot of trainings on offer, I could see, a large amount of staff who have that time dedicated to these types of trainings that aren't necessarily job required but really make a difference. And I could see if we had a good group ready to train on that day. It's usually May, the week around convocation or graduation, right after graduation. The week right after graduation. So that at that point, either the condensed or even the 4 hours, I could see staff taking a morning and doing the intenser version, but something to think about as well.
Thank you. Yeah, that's a great idea.
Any other comments online or in the room? All right. Well, thank you very much, Steve.
Thank you for having me.
So I think we'll skip the officers' reports and come back to those, but we've got our other governance reps in the room, so if we'll just dive right in with Colby first.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
For those of you who don't know me, my name is Colby Friel. I'm the student body vice president. And I apologize for showing up late, but I had a packed morning, so I'm glad I could make the time to come here today. I would just like to share with you some student thoughts on the recent tuition raise approved by the Board of Regents. The day before the Board of Regents meeting, delegates from all student governments around the university system met in Anchorage, and we were all able to go to the Board of Regents meeting the next day and advocate on behalf of our own campuses. There were diverse opinions from all the different campuses, but I would say that the majority opinion supported some tuition increase in some form, and then we saw that happen. We originally anticipated a 9% increase, and UAF students supported that increase. And then Regent Fisher made a motion to decrease that to 5%, and that eventually passed. So students, a sentiment shared by the students is we're willing to do our part to compensate for the budget shortfall. We're currently supporting less than 25% of that shortfall, which is less than we thought we were going to have to do. But we're willing to do our part. That being said, we do expect that the Board of Regents in future budgets and the university system as a whole continues to safeguard those areas of a budget that most directly impacts student achievement, student academic success. And I made that comment to the Board of Regents, and I was surprised by a question I got. A regent asked me, well, what areas most directly impact student success? And that struck me as odd, because I'd hoped that a board of very capable leaders and professionals understood what areas most impact student life and student success, which is not the case. And I don't think that's necessarily true of the entire system, but I think that there's holes that can be filled, and that will be a priority of myself to advocate for those reasons. I think number one is qualified staff and qualified faculty support the educational environment, and the other is continuation of successful programs and continuing to build them strong. I know President Johnson has advocated for vertical cuts and consolidating programs, which I don't know that students have an opinion on, but so long as we have quality programs and quality staff and faculty support our learning, those are our priorities. That's all I wanted to share with you, but I'd be happy to take any questions.
I'll just note very quickly, Colby, I was so impressed with your testimony at the Board of Regents. You did a really excellent job, and it was a pleasure to listen to you, and I was proud to be a UAF alum when you were speaking. So thank you for your great work. Sue?
I guess a question, comment. I have heard a couple of times recently from students that it may be difficult to just graduate in four because of classes that they need not being available at times that are that work. In other words, you know, the class may be only offered once every 3 years or something, and then it has prerequisites they have to take, and then by the time they get around to taking it, it's not available. And then do you see that? Have other students mentioned that to you? Do you think it's a problem?
Well, I'd say yes. I am experiencing that problem myself right now. My department, the theater department, has lost half of its faculty, and this is just an example. Has lost half of its faculty. I'm currently petitioning courses and doing directed study courses to compensate for that. But if my one department is experiencing that, I know many students are experiencing that. So that is a problem, and I think that's an area of focus that students value, and that needs to be a priority for students. So when we're talking about vertical cuts versus horizontal cuts, I think we need to consolidate courses and make them robust so that you have that availability, those course offerings, if nothing else, just to finish your degree. But there's something to be said for the quality of education, too, when you can have the number of course offerings and the quality professors in the numbers that you need them. And that's something that students are concerned about.
I have a quick comment. Can y'all hear me?
Yep.
I'd like to echo the comments earlier, Colby. I was just knocked out. I was completely impressed with how the student body conducted themselves. Normally, I don't know if this is the case, but normally when you're putting together some type of number, like this 9%, tuition increase, which I thought was incredibly high. But you look at the numbers for the budget and you know, that fits. So normally if you got a highball a number like that, close to coming down to some average, but I don't think that was the case this time. You guys successfully lobbied and did a good job with your presentation, so kudos and hats off to you. The other thing with the cloud offerings, I actually went through this, and it is very, very, very difficult. In my particular case, what happened is a particular course was only offered once a year. If you got behind, like let's say you couldn't go for one semester for whatever reason, and you came back into the program, it can set you off as much as a year and a half to 2 years. In the educational program, I'm not sure how it is here in UA, but an educational program, you have two phases. You have your first 2 years, and you have to get admitted into the school of education. So any part between the second and third years, it can really put you in trouble. Most programs require first year scholarships and things of that nature for you to be a full-time student. What could happen and what happened to me is that I completed all my courses minus two that were only available once a year. So at that point, and I was an out-of-state student as well, so that was also a big factor that had to be involved in different things in the university. So those are always things to consider, and I always thought a good idea would be to have some type of system where that individual, I don't know if this is part of the petitioning thing, that individual can actually be offered that class, like on a one-on-one basis or something along those lines. So those are 50 good things to take a look at with the student body as well. So thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
Any other questions for Colby or comments?
I just want to say that I'm super impressed that the students were in support of a tuition increase. I mean, that's the first time I think I've ever heard of that happening. And also the fact that on your list was retaining qualified staff and having qualified staff. That's just, I feel incredibly valued and supported just by that. So, you know, we know that we're here for the students. We know that that's the whole reason we have a university is because we want students to get an education. But it feels really phenomenal to feel valued back. So.
We do value very, very much so.
So much.
Thank you for all your work for the students.
Thank you, Colby.
Thanks.
Great, Orion.
Hello again. So we're actually going to be hearing from Keith for the Green Dot today, in fact. So that was good to get a preview of that. Let's see. So on our agenda for Faculty Senate, we do have more curriculum stuff coming. The transforming O&W course designators into a per-department communication learning outcomes. That's finally a motion that's likely, barring unforeseen complications, to pass today as the official new policy. We also have a motion on the table to the general education requirements, perspectives on the human condition. At the moment, we have a very detailed list of classes. Our plan is to switch to more of a classification list system. So this would be basically you take A humanities, and then here's a longer list. We were actually kind of impressed, Faculty Alliance, that UAA actually figured out how to really streamline their process of being able to change curriculum. At the moment, it takes at least a full year. So I know if I want to teach a course in the fall of next year, that would have had to go into our curriculum, CM Curriculum Council, in August of last year. So that 12 months, that makes it really hard to kind of respond to new, interesting, you know, course opportunities. So I personally would like to get that a little bit faster. We are trying to streamline sort of our process for getting everybody on the same page on what Faculty Senate is doing. We've got an electronic, sort of like an electronic agenda. It's a spreadsheet that just sort of tracks basically what the issues are, who's working on them, where, you know, what's going to happen to them. So that's definitely, I mean, we've talked repeatedly about that here. I really loved your statewide transmission resolution was better than mine, so yours passed. that's great. I was, and this is again kind of a frustration. A deliberative body like the Faculty Senate, it takes a long time to get things sort of, you know, to the point where everybody agrees that they're a good idea. Things are really good when they come out of that process, but it's a lot of time and effort to get there. So mine didn't make it. We had a So speaking of the deliberative process, so sustainability resolution was something we had several folks had asked us to pass. So in particular, they were hoping to find get like $40 per year per staff faculty match for the student sustainability fee. And we ended up not actually covering, so that's one that didn't make it either through the Faculty Senate, that a resolution is probably not the right way for us to exhort people to make donations. And in particular, in this budget climate, it's tough to say people really, we need to mandate that that's going to happen. I'll see other stuff we're doing. There's a bunch of policy updates on Faculty Senate's plate. Actually, in particular, the Blue Book hasn't been updated for about a dozen years, so we need that's the Faculty Evaluation Handbook. And then our bylaws, we have a bunch of bylaw updates that are almost complete. So, yeah. We're definitely sort of, we're ready to help with, I know statewide, So the Board of Regents told the President to look at four focus areas. And I don't know if you've heard these. These are e-learning, teacher education, developmental education, and general education requirements. And the idea is to figure out how we can do those things more effectively, maybe save money, figure out new ways to transform those to make them better. So the President, I know, is actually putting together teams to try and work across all the campuses to figure out how we can, you know, reduce duplicated effort, share share resources, especially on those important tasks. So, questions from you? Yeah.
So some people in my unit have been asking me Common Calendar.
Yeah, Common Calendar. There is a Common Calendar passed for next academic year.
So it will be for 2016.
For 2016, yeah.
And where could we view that?
That's an excellent question. Let's see. It should end up in our meeting minutes.
Okay.
Faculty meeting.
Nicole will check on that and send it out to the group as a follow-up. Thanks, Nicole.
My understanding is that is essentially finalized at this point, though. So.
Thanks, Ryan.
I had two quick notes. One on the communication piece. One thing our group, our Membership and Rules Committee, who also has done their excellent work with the bylaws tracking, something they introduced this year that's been really helpful is kind of a summary that's less formal than the minutes, but is a lot easier to communicate to our constituents.
Yeah.
It's usually one page or less of kind of highlights from the meeting, action items, ways for staff to get involved on the issues we're talking about. That if you guys wanted to take a look as kind of a bulletin outcome that we're using, I think it's been a big improvement to our communication process. So.
Yeah.
And then we also looked at the sustainability fee matching piece we were asked to by the RISE board.
Yeah.
We had a subcommittee look at it who also felt that a formal resolution or endorsement was not appropriate because there are a lot of opportunities for employee giving to all kinds of issues that support good things and support students around campus, and endorsing one without having any kind of process to determine which one felt inappropriate. But I do know the RISE board has put together now a payroll deduction form, and so I think we'll probably have them come give us an update on that and then communicate it out to our constituents. So helping to spread the word, helping to facilitate the opportunity without doing any kind of formal resolution, because I think we thought it was a good idea. We just didn't feel it was appropriate in the same way you guys did, I think. So, any other comments or questions for Orion? What about online for Faculty Senate? Any in the room? All right. Thank you very much. All right, let's take a quick break, 5 minutes, and then we'll come back. Okay, so for folks online, we are reconvening the meeting now and going into our officers' reports. So I'll start. The biggest thing on my plate from a governance perspective was the testimony at the Board of Regents meeting last week in Anchorage. I spoke about the proposed compensation increase for staff, which was 2.5% in line with the union negotiated raises or compensation adjustments. I don't really like the word raise for this because it's generally just meaning that you don't earn less in real dollars each year. When we surveyed staff in the spring across the system, the overwhelming message was we don't want compensation increases if it means our peers are going to be laid off. But with the increasing talk and the guidance from the Chief Budget and Strategy Officer, Michelle Rizik, and from the President about really we're in this budget climate now where we're looking at these vertical reductions, we're looking at which services will we provide or won't we provide. We're looking to try and avoid these across-the-board decreases. That really there's not that one-to-one relationship or that clear relationship between a compensation increase and layoffs that that people had responded to in the spring. And so we did feel that the 2.5% on the base pay was appropriate in keeping with our peers at the university. In the other groups, the Compensation Committee at Staff Alliance discussed this before I gave my testimony. And that it was very important that, especially as we're having fewer people in these higher stress times, that that increase is supported. I'll also note, you know, furloughs have been discussed. It is, depending on how it's implemented, it's better as a staff person to have that increase in before a furlough because then your base pay continues so that when the bad times are over, you know, you're not 3 years behind the economy in your pay. The furloughs are a one-time action, whereas the increase carries forward for your future. So we supported that. The board passed it. It will go to the governor. And then from the governor, if it's in his budget, it will go to the legislature. I expect certainly a lot of discussion if it makes it to the legislature, and we'll see whether or not they allow it to go forward. And whether or not they include their normal funding for it. Normally they cover half of our compensation increases, and we have to absorb the other half. So that'll be something to watch for in the spring. The timeline on that will probably be April, unless it gets drawn out again, like it did this last year. But it did go through the university. Another thing on that the board passed was in the operating budget, additional funding for Title IX support for Title IX coordinators at each campus, or for increasing support for that in terms of positions, which I think is incredibly important to have that well-resourced as we struggle to adapt both as a community and to have our administration handle the cases appropriately. It can't just be one sliver of somebody's job. It's important enough that it really needs to be a focus item. We also spoke about the need for staff involvement and for transparency, or governance involvement, and for transparency with the development of any contingency budget. The budget that was passed by the regents is what we believe is in the best case of the university. It's not based on what we expect the legislature will necessarily agree to fund. It actually included a slight increase over last year. So, and in fact, we expect to receive a substantial decrease. So looking at how that'll be handled and how it'll be absorbed at UAF, we are still awaiting the formation of the Planning and Budget Committee. I expect we'll have a staff representative on that in the coming year once they get formed. I know it won't be me because it'll be part of my day job to be supporting that committee, but we'll kind of keep an eye on that, and as it gets formed, bring that forward. And then as you heard from Colby on the tuition increase, the Regents did pass a 5% increase, which means across the entire UA system, compared to the 9% increase that was proposed, that's about a $5 million impact to the budget of getting the 5% instead of the 9%. At UAS, most of the students are at UAA, so most of the tuition revenue is through UAA. At UAF, I would expect that impact to be between maybe $1 million and $1.5 million to the UAF budget of not having that increase. So we'll see basically what that means in terms of the Planning Budget Committee, the target reductions that that UAF has to absorb. But I would expect something along in that range, basically, as an impact. We also have had a fairly steady trend of decreasing enrollment over the last few years, in part because we've had fewer high school graduates in Alaska, and high school graduates in Alaska are our biggest pool of potential students, so as there's fewer of them, there's fewer to come here. I think it's been around 3.5% fewer students, or fewer student credit hours each year. Headcount varies, but it's credit hours that matter from a budget perspective, from a tuition perspective. So, the impact of that with the tuition increase does mean that we won't be seeing as much relief to the budget there as we could have, but still that 5% does make a difference. And so much gratitude for the students for supporting it as well. And we did talk earlier about the statewide transformation team and next steps there. So I think that covers, and we also talked about some of the other staff alliance items earlier. I'll continue to push on the leave share resolution. I'm very eager to see that finalized after all this time. It's long overdue. So any questions for me? I actually do have a question for you guys, which is the next Board of Regents meeting is in Fairbanks in December. It's a normal two-day meeting, and there will be public testimony as usual. The students across the system did an incredible job with their testimony in Anchorage. I think we have the opportunity to do some really good testimony here, but it would be good to know kind of what do you guys want the Regents to know? What do you think are the most important things for our Regents to hear or to know from us? So just, I'll toss that open if anyone wants to.
I think from my unit's perspective that they need to remember that research is bringing in a huge impact to the university and to the state in terms of dollars coming in, and that should needs to be protected in order to support the student and the university as a whole.
I would echo that, and also I often get the feeling that between research and academic, a lot of the support roles that staff members perform for those seem to feel undervalued. I know that's a really general thing and that everybody basically feels undervalued all the time, but I feel like often some of the support systems for students what people feel like are administrative roles that aren't, they don't actually qualify as administrative roles. They tend to be deemed unnecessary or overfunded or whatever it is. And a lot of these systems are systems that support success, and without those systems, the students have a hard time succeeding. And it's I feel like there's a disconnect between the services that we provide that are not, academic departments, and but are still really pretty crucial for students to succeed.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. So thinking in terms of testimony that will resonate with the regents, that will be something that they really take to heart, I would encourage you guys over the next week or two to think about if you have kind of concrete examples with real human beings behind that, where you could send me an email. You know, if you know of a case of particularly an individual, it always resonates a little more, who has that kind of impact and makes that difference. That would be something that I think we would really want to share forward. Any others? And Chris, to answer your question back on the leave share, it should be going to the president for his signature any day now. We're waiting to hear. So I've followed up with statewide HR on that. So any other items that we feel are really important to communicate to the regents? All right, if you guys think of any, like I said, just send me an email. And again, the more personal and relatable it is, compared to these big broad ideas, I think it resonates more. If we have a big broad idea within a personal example to back it up, that tends to, I think, be a little more effective just from watching their reactions over the last few meetings. I would ask that certainly any you think of over the next month would be great, but if you're able to spend some time in the next week thinking about it, the sooner we have some of these identified, we can get a little more organized and have a really powerful testimony. So I'll ask for that shorter timeline.
And when is that Board of Regents meeting?
I think it's the 9th and 10th. There's something, I think, in the second week of December for 2 days. Usually it's a Thursday, Friday, but... Oh, yeah.
Thursday and Friday, prior to the last week.
Okay.
So not Friday the 18th, but the Friday before, except Thursday and Friday.
So 11th and 12th, or 10th and 11th, maybe. 10th and 11th, and that'll be in the Board of Regents Conference Room, which is up in the Butrovich Building. Certainly everyone is welcome to be there in person and in the room for public testimony. They have asked in the past that we do try to organize our public testimony as much as possible, so not to have 10 people come up and speak individually to the same specific issue, but rather if there's 3 people who come up and sit together and speak to a specific issue and then say, and the rest of the people in the room are here to support that and they all stand up, that's more effective than 10 or 15 people speaking to the same item. They get rather frustrated with that and it starts to lose its impact. So something to think about. I'd like to try to organize some of this as well, with the caveat that it is public testimony, so everyone is perfectly acceptable for everyone to go speak about whatever they want to, really. It doesn't have to be cleared through me or anything like that, but I think if we had some organized, it would be very, very effective. All right. Nate?
Yeah. Most of what I have is covered elsewhere on the agenda, so I'll be quick. Just take the opportunity for a minute to editorialize. We're hosting my wife's parents for Thanksgiving, so I'm practicing what I'm thankful for. So the first thing is I'm thankful that we have Faye. She did a great job advocating and representing both staff council and Alliance. So thanks, Faye. And then the other thing is I spent a lot of the weekend reading about Yale and Missouri and the problems that they have and they've been dealing with, and also the sort of what I regard as terrible leadership there. And so I would say that I'm thankful that we have leaders here, some of them new, to do things like take responsibility and offer accountability for inadequacies or failures that have happened here. So one of those examples is, I assume that everybody's read Chancellor Powers' statement from a few weeks ago regarding Title IX. If you haven't read it or if you'd like to read it again, I would certainly encourage that. It's I think it's strong, and I think it's strong in ways that university leadership is not typically, not just here, but all around the country. So I think that that's important, and I think that that's an important example for us. This is an organization. I don't know. You know, I guess another thing I'm thankful for is Police Chief Mallard. I think that it was great that he was here, and I think that, like Trish, I have heard a lot about Green Dot over the last year or two, and it hasn't really been clear to me what the functions of the program are or exactly how it works. And so I've been thankful to Chancellor Powers and to Police Chief Mallard for focusing on that and clarifying it and offering opportunities like the town hall a couple weeks ago, because it has done a lot, I think, for me and for other faculty and staff to understand how we fit in that equation. I think that there's been a lot of rightly so clarification about in times of budget crisis. I think that there's a lot of discussion about what the functions of the university are, and I think that to clarify the ways in which we support student success is good. But in terms of like a hierarchy of needs perspective, I think the safety of students and staff and faculty, it's hard to come up with something more important than that. So I'm thankful that there's been focus on that. Another document that I've kind of revisited, just in that light, which I'm sure that many of you have read, but if you haven't or if you'd like to read it again, it's an article from about a year ago in The Atlantic about sexual assault, sexual violence in Alaska in general. I think that that's good to sort of keep in mind about the initial investigation, the initial listing of the University of Alaska under Title IX investigations, and then sort of how that investigation has happened because of, what I regard as sort of a general attention to sexual violence in the state, and then kind of what that investigation has uncovered and how it's kind of changed our focus and how, in my hope, how it will change our culture, as the chief talked about. So that's, like I said, that's a little bit of an editorial, but I think that those are just been some of the things on my mind. So that's all.
Thank you very much, Nate. I think that's really, really important to speak to and to raise those two items in particular to refer to, because they're really important to keep thinking about. And one thing for me personally, too, that I felt when I saw the chancellor's message, and I heard that, the finding that was being announced, or the issue that was being announced, was that out of, I don't know how many, 40-something, that five we hadn't followed up on appropriately. At first, I felt very like, oh, well, okay, that's not so bad. That's not terrible. But then being reminded that behind each one of those cases was a pretty horrific incident in and of itself, that that in each of those cases something truly, truly terrible happened here on our campus. And so I applaud the administration for trying to get their response right and looking forward to really making sure that we respond appropriately when these things happen. But as Nate mentioned and as Chief Mallard mentioned, being proactive about this so that these things aren't happening in the first place, so that responding right is absolutely important. But man, if we didn't have to respond at all, that would be a lot better. These are not trivial. They're not trivial cases that we're responding to. So thanks for bringing those pieces to light too. I think that Atlantic piece in particular had some real heavy thoughts in it that are good to remember. We shouldn't take these things lightly. Thank you again, Nate.
Yep.
So on that note, let's roll into our chancellor's comments. Thank you for being here today.
Well, thank you. Yeah, thanks for the opportunity to address some of these issues. Just a reminder, who do we have online?
Do you guys want to go through online real quick and say your names for us and your unit?
This is Jane Rosclos from Unit 7.
And I'm not sure our chancellor knows what our unit numbers mean as well, so if we might say the name just for his benefit.
So that's USA University of Unit 7.
Thank you. Are you able to read those messages, Chancellor?
I am.
Okay.
Hi, my name is Chris Brooks, School of Issues and Nursing Science in Indiana.
Great, thank you. And anyone else? Okay, hearing none. A couple items to keep you up to date on. I'll mention. I'll start with Title IX. I'll end on the budget. What we know, at least at the moment. A lot of work, really, on Title IX right from the start of the year. September 1, Nate had mentioned the town hall meeting, which was the showing of the movie, and then the town hall meeting, and I believe three other focus groups. After that, pages of ideas. Last Friday, we met a group of 16 to begin to map out these ideas in a strategic effort for the next year. That will be completed next Tuesday, and we hope to have it in a final form, hopefully by the end of the week, next week or early the following week. At that point, the strategic activity surrounding Title IX, continued education, training, green dot training, freeing up funds needed for various initiatives, communications for the next year will be picked up by the full cabinet and reported on bimonthly. And I will certainly use this opportunity to keep staff council up to date as we start moving down the trail. A number of things have been done already, which is great. But this puts the entire, literally hundred projects, ideas, initiatives that were identified into a coherent map that we can track and pay attention to progress being made. The employment engagement survey, we should have results next week. We'll share that with leadership, and then we'll roll those results out shortly after. That'll be a good baseline. And obviously, these are very, very tough times, and I can imagine there'll be room for improvement. A reminder, Arctic Science Summit Week is the week of spring break. March 12th to the 20th. On Friday the 18th in particular, we'll have 1,000 scientists from around the world on campus during that time, and we'll be needing help from across the campus with registration and working the doors and note-taking and some technical expertise. And you'll be hearing more about that, but if you are around, we're exploring ideas on how to free up time to help support that showcase, which will bring international spotlight to the campus. We have a leadership forum the week of Thanksgiving. I believe it is scheduled for Tuesday, and that's an open meeting, typically held in the fall and then in the spring, to address issues. We're just putting that effort together now. And then I walked in late. Faye and Nate and I had talked about this testimony at the Regents' meetings. Glad to see that was discussed. When I served on the Regents, it was always valuable to hear from faculty, staff, and students. Always, but it's important without going too far down the orchestration path to get organized somewhat. You want to hit about 2.5 minutes. You want to practice before
you testify. As Faye had mentioned, if there are like issues, come together as a group, make good use of efficient use of the time allotted, and really give some thought to some meaningful suggestions and improvements. It's an opportunity not just to criticize or constructively criticize, but to constructively criticize and then to offer some solutions. Always appreciated, always. So if you can put yourself in the shoes of the regents and think through what will come across most meaningful, and that's typically solutions and ideas to issues that can be resolved. I'm glad to see you're thinking about maybe a little bit of training. That's always helpful. And it puts the campus in a very good light, by the way, when faculty, staff, students come forward and articulate good, the bad, and the ugly, and offer some suggestions on improvements. Just so you know, the Title IX has really been all-consuming in many ways, but now we're clearly into the budget development and process. And as you know, we had a 9% tuition hike proposed. 5% was passed. In terms of capital, the number one capital item that was agreed on system-wide is the engineering building here in Fairbanks and deferred maintenance. And for us in Fairbanks, it's absolutely critical, an $800 million price tag on that. And it's so critical to keep those buildings up. So a base budget was passed, but we expect, and we'll see this change through the coming months during the legislative session, one, what the budget what the governor puts in his budget, and then secondly, what the legislature ultimately funds. But it's going to be tough. We're looking right now, very early, at a $26 million gap, and we are going to have to thoughtfully, diligently address this, and it's going to be a rough year. So this week we hope to get a memo out with some of the, more of the details, this is obviously a very difficult time for the state of Alaska and for the university, and we'll start to develop our contingency budgets now that the formal ask has been submitted. So that's where we are. That's the update.
Thank you. So I'd like to just take the opportunity to advocate on both with budget, with planning and budget committee, and with the employee engagement follow through and planning, implementation planning. I think those are two areas where a staff council representative on any committee would be really helpful in both directions. Mm-hmm. And so I hope that as those committees are formed, we're offered the chance to nominate a representative to serve on them.
Point well taken. Yeah.
Okay. I
would expect that.
Thank you. What about, let's start online. Any questions or comments for Chancellor Powers?
I have two questions.
Yes.
So the first is regarding the Green Dot program and the Title IX initiative. I've heard from a couple of sources now that securing funding is like one of the right now major sort of roadblock, and I'm just kind of wondering why that is. Like, you know, it's clear that it's an initiative that we care pretty strongly about. It's clear that it's really important and that we're legally required to do it. So I'm surprised that funding keeps coming up as an issue. And I know that, you know, it's not easy to, you know, say, okay, well, we're going to reallocate these funds and move on with life, but it feels like that's been a hang-up for a while.
Sure. Good question. Couple thoughts. One is, as you know from the from the last week's meeting, this is going to be a very difficult budget year. So you're looking at a $26 million gap that we're going to be absolutely scrutinizing every aspect of operations. We have to. So that's just one huge hurdle. Secondly, there's some discussion right now. This is a statewide initiative which Fairbanks is taking the lead on, Title IX, and consequently there's some thought that statewide would fund this. On the other hand, there's some discussion at the statewide level that, well, Fairbanks is taking the lead on it. Fairbanks should fund this. That's another element of negotiation. The third issue that goes through my mind, Nate and Faye and I had talked about this on the volunteer day that Chancellor Rogers signed off on, and I think is a wonderful opportunity for the university to engage with the community. There is an argument, I'll be the first to make it, that perhaps we look after ourselves first and become an example for the community, and maybe Green Dot training is one of those areas where there's some potential participation with the university in funding that half day if there's a half day personal day. We're still discussing that. But because training and education is so important, so needed, and yet it's one more thing on an already busy calendar of the entire staff, maybe there's a way we could lighten that load, and that would be through that volunteer effort. So three things. One is just this unprecedented budget gap we're dealing with. Two is the discussion between statewide and UAF on levels of participation. And then three, there may be some opportunities either with reallocating funds and or using things like the volunteer day to help support such an important initiative. Bottom line is I think the Green Dot program is probably going to be one of the elements of this continued cultural shift of campus safety, especially when you get leaders like Chief Mallard and others. Does that help?
Yeah, that's great. The other question that I have is regarding the employment engagement survey.
Yes.
When that comes out, what kind of data will be available to the general populace? Will that include everything, including, you know, the pre-type questions and everything, or will it be scaled back and sort of digested already?
I don't know what the history at UAF is. I can tell you what we did at Fairbanks Memorial, and that will impact my thinking to some degree, but I certainly will be listening to staff, council, faculty, and the leadership. But typically, when you have, you know, potentially hundreds, thousands of results, you bring it back into key important dimensions of a survey. I'm going to guess maybe somewhere between 10 and 20. I haven't seen the survey myself, by the way. And then from that, you would categorize some of the free text comments into various themes, so you get a relatively high-level look at the building blocks of engagement, or what is preventing greater levels of engagement. I would hope there would be opportunities through the vendor, and then obviously through sessions we'll have with all employees, ideas on how to address those major themes. When dealing with such huge volumes of information, obviously, some type of meaningful summary is probably the best way to attack an improvement plan.
So, if you don't mind, I'll jump in really quickly too. Just based on the conversations with Anita and Carla on this, I would actually be shocked if every comment that was submitted was available for reading. I think that they were very clear that all the individual data will go to the consultant, but the university will not get anything that could be that could possibly identify an individual for confidentiality reasons. That what the university will get back from
the consulting firm is a summarized report. It'll have some by, I think they said, aggregated at no more or no fewer than 10 responses per group. So if every individual comment in the free text was available for public viewing, I think that would seriously contradict some of their the principles they were using for confidentiality. So I wouldn't expect that. I think, as the Chancellor noted, very likely I would expect summarization of the free text comments after they've gone through them and seen what themes evolve. But I believe people commented, provided those comments with the expectation that they wouldn't be shared publicly as individual comments. So.
Great, thank you.
Yes.
I would just like to clarify on the, you mentioned the $26 million budget cap. Is that system-wide or UAF?
That's UAF. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Largely related to compensation. Other questions online or in the room?
Hi, do you have a desktop?
Yes.
Okay, so we have another $26 million gap this year. And we have multiple years of these deficits. Does the administration have a solid number as far as how the point of return versus the bottom line?
Okay, so breaking up a little bit there, a solid number related to?
What is that return? Yeah, it's really diverse to provide adequate service.
I am not aware of that scenario, that black swan scenario planning. University having been around for 100 years and so critical to, in my opinion, the development of the state. There may be great changes down the line, program mergers between the three campuses, but a state university system with a tradition and a level of support, as crazy as it sounds because of what happened last week, that we're seeing from the state right now. There'll always be a University of Alaska. What it looks like, I don't know, and what some of those. I'm the number one fan of KUAC, and I think it is a wonderful, vibrant program that should be associated with this campus at UAF. But that would be a special program that you would have to review, because I know there's many who think, well, public radio maybe is not part of the core mission of a campus. It would be my hope that it certainly would be, but that would be an example of programs that could be potentially spun off, or other opportunities, organizations could pick them up, and you would begin to take on those special programs. But ultimately, you come back to your mission of research, teaching, and service, and make sure all functions, all special programs tie directly to your mission. Bottom line is, we don't have a point of no return. In my point is, there will always be a University of Alaska. What it looks like, I don't know.
Yes. I just wanted to comment on. You mentioned using possibly, it's still early, but using the idea of the staff volunteer day or sort of volunteer time to help provide for that green dot training. And I just wanted to comment, and again, I know it's very early in that process, but I think our idea was that this would really be a community opportunity that we could say, UAF could say, we're out helping our community partners. And I'm mildly concerned if we see it, if we see it as a, hey, you should volunteer to take this training, And the green dot training is maybe a little bit different, but you could imagine that, say, with safety training. Oh, yeah, volunteer to take your safety training. And I'm, like I said, a little, it's very early to say, but that's a minor concern I have, or something I would want to raise if we go further that way.
I appreciate that. I can also say that Nate has been a strong advocate of that very point as well, and he said, really, this is about the community. I keep raising the issue. If there was a choice, I think the university has a opportunity to be a community leader in being an example, but it would certainly have to be a choice not to take away that partnership with the community that you're talking about, which is very, very important. I get that. I also appreciate your saying early discussions as we're kicking ideas around.
Leslie, I'm sorry, but we can't hear you. It's very garbled coming through. Yeah, if you type it, that would be great. Thank you. Sorry about that. While she's typing, too, one thing that we mentioned to Keith while he was here as well was really encouraging the use of the Staff Development Day, which happens every May, mm-hmm. for Green Dot Training as well, where that's a day where staff are encouraged to do training and development activities, where that time is kind of set aside and encouraged. That would just be the more opportunities for Green Dot Training, the better, I think, was our message. But that's a day where we're already looking for those types of opportunities as a, you know, just another venue.
Good suggestion.
There's your question, but maybe volunteer time could be used to share the Green Dot program out to the community.
Mm-hmm. Great idea. Yeah, right.
Yeah, that could be a really, really great opportunity. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so ASAP. Main purpose of the advocacy committee is to promote the value of the staff to the community.
So I think Leslie's just pointing out that the volunteer day proposal originally came from the advocacy committee, and the way that that committee defines itself is according to how well it can reflect the importance of staff, of UAS staff, to the university committee and then to the sort of wider community.
Okay, so Leslie, what I'm hearing is once again endorsement of a true community connection. Point well taken.
Thank you, Trish.
So when the Office of Management and Budget first started working, when we first started getting the budget challenges, they did a lot of work in collecting a lot of ideas from all over campus. And kind of divvied it up into the low-hanging fruit that had a big payback and another group that they kind of called, was it Death by a Million Paper Cuts? And so they said, you know, we don't want to do Death by a Million Paper Cuts. So I'm wondering if at this point that's something we could start looking at again, because it's not each of us having a million paper cuts. It's each of us maybe having 10. So if we could start looking at some of that, maybe a little bit harder to go after. I mean, maybe if some of that stuff was even just posted, where we could say, oh, we could find a way to implement that in our department, some way of sharing more of those cost-cutting ideas that are maybe smaller, but a whole bunch of small ones all across campus could make a difference.
I'm actually headed back to the full cabinet. I'm going to bring this up. But what you're saying is resurrect that list of ideas from A to Z. Okay. Thank you.
And I think the idea, too, that, you know, ones that might not have been practicable or make a lot of sense to implement university-wide, where they might be good suggestions that departments could look to for their internal adjustments, because we are seeing still some of those horizontal cuts where departmental budgets are being reduced, or maybe there's something in that list that might help a department or two get things figured out internally.
Do you know if the gift certificate idea ever went forward?
I'm not sure where where that went. It was approved to work through, so I think it would be between, actually, you might know, because I think Raj was going to work with Amanda on it. It was to have a tuition gift certificate or tuition and fees where people could, you know, somebody's grandmother could get them a $100 university gift certificate or pay for $100 of their stuff.
People are buying Christmas presents now, so if we could get them.
Yeah.
So, I
will follow up with them on that. That was one of the recommendations of the revenue subcommittee over the spring, was to have this tuition gift certificate idea to help,
mm-hmm.
where it might make a difference to a student attending or not, if they were able to crowdsource some of their funding for their education.
Very good.
That was one that came from Trish, and the committee really loved, so it was great to see that connection. So.
Other questions, either online or here? Okay, hearing none, thank you. It's always a pleasure. I enjoy coming to these meetings and appreciate the questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, we'll run through our unfinished business, fall election update. Brandy, do you want to say a few words on where we are with the election?
So it opened up as scheduled and closed on December 3rd, 30 days later. And so right now we've been kind of stagnant because there's not a lot that can be done until voting comes in. It's critical in helping out with voting supervisory approval. And when we met last Thursday.
Brandy, I'm so sorry. They can't hear you online.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So, voting is going to close on the 3rd of December as scheduled, 30 days after it opened. And we had our committee meeting a week earlier than planned. We met last week, and as of last Thursday, 10% of staff had voted, which is pretty high, according to Nicole, compared to historically. And everything's on track. She's been pretty critical in helping vet out supervisory access, or approval, excuse me. And I hope to have a better update in December after votes are tallied.
Great. And will we be sending out a like a reminder?
There will be a reminder.
Okay, great. Great. Thank you. Staff mentoring interest survey. Jamie, do you have an update there?
Oh, wow.
She was ready.
I might just read that if you don't mind. So this is in the committee report as well. They'll be inviting either Brad and or Margo from HR to their next committee meeting to discuss the expectations of mentoring, what's involved. The survey results said staff are interested, but looking at structure, guidelines, how it might be incorporated into the initial training program for new employees. And Phil Jacobs had volunteered to start some of those guidelines for discussion at their meeting, which is scheduled for this Wednesday. I'm looking for further updates after that meeting. Nicole has the results and has kindly offered to assist as needed. Thank you, Jamie. Any questions for Jamie on that one? And thanks for putting that in the committee report, too. That was very helpful. On the Chancellor search update, so the committee met twice to discuss and work on the job posting, the profile, some of the information that will be used in the recruitment. The consultant who basically will work as kind of a frontline manager of everything as it comes in, he'll also work on actually going out and recruiting candidates. Who might not be actively looking at job postings, but who we might want to steal away from other universities, for example. He has a lot of those relationships and will be going out and actively soliciting candidates as well. If you have an idea of someone who would be a fantastic candidate, you can nominate someone, basically. If you have questions on that, just let me know. That should be actually going live and opening up quite shortly, so you can start recruiting. And then applications will be accepted through January 15th. The committee will be reviewing them as they come in. We will select semi-finalists to interview, probably 8 to 10. And then once we've spoken with those, we'll come up with maybe 3 or 4 finalist candidates. Up until the point that finalists are selected, it's completely confidential. So we won't be able to share much about that. I would like to invite Paul Reichart, the committee chair, to come to a future staff council meeting and give an update on the process. It's better if the messages from the committee come through him as opposed to from me, just so that I don't accidentally say something I'm not supposed to. We expect to have the finalists announced and coming for on-campus visits in March. So they would come in March. We would have an opportunity to meet them with all the governance groups, much as we did with the interim candidate, you know, town hall forums, very intensive day or two, meeting the groups on campus. Then the committee will share a summary of our findings and thoughts with the president, who will make the ultimate selection, ideally making his selection by the end of April, potentially early May, so that the new chancellor could be in place in June or July. Interim Chancellor Powers, who's graciously agreed to serve as the interim chancellor, has made it very clear that he's hoping to not be chancellor through the entire summer. He's looking for that transition soon after the end of the semester. So that's the timeline. I don't think there'll be much news or opportunity for feedback on that unless you have someone to nominate until we get to the finalists, basically, from my understanding of the process and what we're allowed to share. We really need to maintain the confidentiality so that the good candidates won't be scared off. If they think that it might become public knowledge that they've applied, they won't apply for a lot of them because they're at a high enough level in their current positions that that wouldn't be worth it to them, I think. So, I'll share updates on the timeline as I have them, and I can share, you know, if people have questions about the general process. But other than that,
I would say don't have them come during spring break.
No.
When the Arctic Science Summit Week is going on.
Excellent point, yeah. And we would want to make sure that our students were around, too, for the governance meetings there. So we had talked about trying to speed up the timeline so that they'd have to come during February so we'd know who really was willing to come stick it out after seeing it at 30 below in dark. But the timeline to get a really good pool of candidates, that does seem to mean March. But we're expecting within the first 2 weeks of March, early March, for those on-campus interviews is the target. All right. And we do still need another representative for the Staff Health Care Committee from Staff Alliance. So please, yes.
I had volunteered before and I've never heard from them.
Oh, did we get that? Sorry, we might just have dropped the ball on our end. Did we get her?
That wasn't recently, was it? When I first joined Staff Council. I'll send you an email.
Yeah, sorry about that. As a rep or as an alternate? I think we need one more rep and one more alternate. Yeah, as a rep. Okay.
Great.
Awesome.
So I'll volunteer as an alternate then.
Excellent. Thank you, Sue. All right. Got that? Great. We'll get your names submitted to the committee. I don't think they've met yet this year, so we're not too far behind. Yeah, Leslie says they're scheduled to meet on the 20th or 29th? My eyes aren't good enough. 20th. Okay, so we'll get your name sent up this week. All right, internal committee reports. Brandy, anything else to add?
Pretty much just what I did above.
Great. Trish?
They can read the written report and just the pieces that apply to the motion. I'll say once we get to the motion.
Great. Thank you. Chris Brooks.
I'm sorry. Yeah, Jerry?
Yep.
Okay, yes, we had our last meeting on October 15th. Basically, our topics were, it looks like we got success at SMC, the student main center with timely reimbursements of test reports. After bringing these concerns and issues to light, I believe progress has been made. There have been no further reports in college. So that looks pretty good there. For beginning a discussion on surveying rural campuses and facilities, I know we've probably been all surveyed out lately. It seems like there's just one or two or three every week. But the rural parent community, really, what we really need is more input from our constituents to set priorities in the community. And one of the problems, I think, is that, you know, a lot of these facilities and campuses are pretty small, and so there might be some type of fear to report anything. You know, we're looking to give a safe avenue from the fear. Last year, two of our community members, I brought that up before, so we're running kind of slow now. And several of the committees we had talked about in our executive problem, that people should be aware of that and you know, should make the next effort to make this meeting because they are
So, Chris, you started to break up a bit at the end, but that was actually something I meant to address in my comments at the beginning as well. All of our committees have reported real challenges with attendance at committee meetings. The committee meetings can't function and be effective without solid attendance from members. If you're not going to be able to make it, just let your chair know in advance, and maybe the committee can reschedule a time or can find an alternate way to meet. But this attendance is really, really important, and so we need to be better about attendance. It's one of the two key responsibilities, or three key responsibilities, I guess, of reps. So just a reminder of how important that is. And, yeah, if you have any concerns about being able to attend a meeting, reach out to your chair. These meetings times are not set in stone. Especially if a large number aren't going to be able to make it, then we can just reschedule them. So, Chris, that is what you were talking about, right?
Yes.
Okay. Did you have anything else?
Yeah, sorry. I just wanted to this Wednesday, and we will not.
So I lost you at the end. We heard the next meeting is this Wednesday at 2 o'clock, and
we will not be in December.
No meeting in December. Great. Thank you. All right, staff affairs, Jean.
Yeah, so we do not have a committee report attached, but we did meet this past month, but we have been suffering from low attendance for a couple of meetings now. I did send out a Google poll to evaluate if we possibly changing our meeting time. If you are on the staff affairs committee and did not receive that, definitely let me know because that's a problem. It means you're not on my email list, and I want to make sure that everybody's on it. We generally meet on the third Monday of the month. And if that's not a good meeting time for everyone, I guess I'm going to address that. Super interested right now that we're discussing are the staff morale issue and the related issues to that. I'm looking forward to us picking up the grievance versus review process and really looking at what we can do, what we want to do there, and then
also the employee evaluation conversation we wanted to put on the back burner through the page up launch. So yeah, if anyone has any questions during our meeting times or anything like that, let me know. And if you're not able to make it again, just let me know.
Great, thank you. And University Advocacy, Jamie. We saw your written report, yes, and the comment. Meeting on November 11th, mentoring initiative, also efforts to coordinate staff health and wellness exercise classes through DRAW. So working on a survey to figure out what classes people might work and what days, timing. Katie Miller at DRAW is very enthusiastic about working with us to make that happen. Ideally having the classes be free for staff as long as we can find a way to pay the instructor fee, which if you look in the committee report attached, it has a little more information. It's about $10 to $15 an hour, so pretty nominal. Mm-hmm. It'd be a great opportunity for staff to take part in additional health and wellness options. So this is great because this is something that, you know, with Healthy Roads being at a system level, we've asked before and heard that, no, they can't partner with DRAW as well because that would only be available to some staff and not to others. But this might be something that we can do on our own with existing resources at the university to take advantage of some great programs that they have. So I'm really glad you guys are looking into this and heartened by the progress you've made. So I look forward to hearing more on that. That's something that I think has been missed, some of those wellness breaks that we had in the last program. So. All right, staff achievements and highlights. I received one through email, which I'm sad he had to leave, but it was for Phil Jacobs on our elections committee. He's done some really excellent work with the election software in this go-around. We wouldn't be able to have successful elections without that software operating smoothly, and he took that project on and ran with it. So big kudos to Phil. And then I mentioned earlier Tom Langdon, who's with OIT. Really, really phenomenal job with working on some of the feedback to the statewide transformation team report. Do you have any others to share?
We had a really active Aurora the last a while ago, and there was so much activity on the Geophysical Institute website that it crashed the whole GI website server, and Paul Dulles fixed it very quickly, did something that made it run much better. I don't understand the technicalities. And over a three-day period, we had 3 million hits.
Wow.
That website. They were recorded, not when it was down. Mm-hmm. So it was a huge, the GI's Aurora forecast website is extremely popular.
Wow. Yeah, that's fantastic. And Paul, for those of you who don't know him, Paul is just a wonderful human being in addition to being a whiz. So I'm glad to hear that one. I'd also make a note, some of these achievements and highlights too can be excellent short blurbs in testimony to the Board of Regents, kind of giving a sense of the scale of things that we do. Even some of the ones that have come up in past months, just as kind of reminder, now that they're here in Fairbanks, it would be good. I loved the one about the Denali being the correct. Yeah, that was a staff person. That's someone we represent. So really great. And some of the ones that Leslie shared with the hydropower in the river and some of these research ones, and then also, you know, the student side and just the, wow, like working crazy hours or last minute scramble to get things done, where we've really made some great saves. So any others that people want to share today? All right. Thank you, guys. New business. We have a motion from membership and rules following up on our past discussions about what to do when a representative changes units. So this is based on all the feedback they took in and received. Take it away, Trish.
Okay. Thank you. This is Trish Winters. And our membership and rules committee had put out a survey. You might recall the membership of staff council had taken a poll in the meeting and said if a representative changes jobs and it ends up putting them in a different unit for whatever reason, or in a different unit than the one they were elected to represent, the group was polled and said they want to retain those representatives. So M&R was asked to find the correct way to do that. And so we put together a survey that we sent out to all of the staff council reps, and we listed out three options, and then we had a fourth that people could write in. And so when those results came in, we had really great number of responses. I think, I don't have it in front of me, but I think we had like 26 responses. I mean, it was great response rate. And number one, the option number one was the clear winner. And so we took that one, and Jessica very kindly wrote it up as a motion for us. And so that's what's attached here to the draft agenda for today. And so I'm just going to read this. So the membership and rules committee would like to make a motion. UAS staff council moves to amend the organization's bylaws to add language to address representatives changing units as follows. This motion amends and adds language in Section 3 to address when staff council members move from one unit to another in the middle of their term. The term elected is added to Section 3A7 to differentiate between elected and special at-large representatives, because the option number one that everyone selected was to retain them as a special at-large representative. We called it floating in the survey, but to be more in line with bylaw language, as Brad pointed out to us, the special is the correct term to use. And so we changed that to say special at-large. So elected is added to Section 3A7 to differentiate between elected and special at-large representatives. Section 3A8 and Section 3B3 are added to allow representatives to stay on staff council after their unit changes. And the rest of the document just shows where those things go in. But we did add language in Section 3A. Let's see if I have this right. 3A8 says, special at-large representative seats may be established according to Section 3B3. Special at-large representatives would retain full staff council rights and privileges. And then under vacancies, we added number 3. When an elected representative vacates their seat due to a unit change, they may choose to move to a special at-large seat until the next election for their new unit. So that's the motion that we would like to bring to staff council.
Do I hear a second to that motion?
I'll second.
All right. So for discussion, any edits or amendments?
Well, I had a question just to clarify. It seems like then the decision about whether there is a special representative resides with the representative who's moving, right? It's their choice. It's not up to a staff council vote or appointment by the chair or anything.
Okay. That's right. All right. Any other discussion? Amendments? Edits? Okay, and we need a roll call vote for this, right? All right, so Nicole, if you would.
Evelyn Pinscord?
Thanks, Evelyn. Chad Olson?
No.
Leslie Walls? Melody Hughes? Allie Englert?
Aye.
Jamie Ward?
I don't think Jamie's on.
She just left, yeah.
Justice here. Sue Mitchell?
Yes.
Mercedes Anderson?
Yes.
Chris Brooks?
Abstain.
Is that an abstain? Mm-hmm. Could you type that in, Chris? Sorry. Abstain.
Jane Grossclose?
Yes.
Matthew Munns is not here. Kim Eames is not here. Susie Fry? Stacey Haberschill?
Yes.
Brandy Marrero?
Yes.
Jessica Armstrong? Dean Ojala, I don't think he's here. Jessica McGowan?
Yes.
Brad Crick?
No.
Janelle Merrifield?
Yes.
Phil is not here. Connie? Selena? Thanks, Selena. And Trish.
Hi.
Motion passes 14-4-2 against and one abstained.
Thank you. And thanks to that committee for taking on a pretty meaty issue for us. All right, announcements really quick. The staff council calendar photo, we did have a winner. It was option number 4 out of the finalists, which was with some snowy trees and water and mountains in the background. It did not have a title, so it's currently referred to as the one with some snowy trees and mountains and water.
I have a title. I don't
know. Okay. We got the title after voting. So that's great. And as we have more news on the calendar, we'll get that out.
So we still don't know if we're going to be able to print it or not.
It's looking like we may be able to print something, but it's unquestionably not going to be the same size. It'll end up kind of depending on what kind of quotes we get.
Quotes, we're looking at pricing now. The compensation increase, 2.5% for staff, did go through the Board of Regents. As I mentioned earlier, the tuition increase was proposed at 9%, passed at 5%, discussed that. And really quick, actually, this just I was reminded of and I want it on the record, but I learned last week that we have a special kind of parking pass that people can get if they are, for example, new mothers who are dealing with nursing and need to have kind of quick access to the building, or if their infant is being brought to them
for nursing, and it's on the top of the form, it says this is to make UAF a better place to work. It was definitely something we saw when we did the Better Place to Work survey a while ago, was this family friendliness. And we, since we have someone from the bursary's office, maybe you could give just a quick bit of context, because I didn't see enough to know, but I thought we should share it.
And I was going to add to that that there is a form out there that you can get this special pass that gets you either like in a handicapped space, if you have documentation from your doctor's office, or can get you in like a meter spot, so you can be closer to buildings and things like that for quick or easy access. And not only does it cover having infant and things like that, but also women in their third trimester, as when it, you know, on the pregnancy aspect, as well as other things that are medically necessary for need of that. You do have to have a current decal purchased, but it doesn't need to be a gold decal, it can just be a regular decal, and then apply for the pass through that.
So yeah, I think that's a fantastic thing we do that I wasn't sure that many people, I was shocked when I heard about it. I had no idea that we offered this. But I think especially in winter for people who work on lower campus, not having to walk up from those lower lots in your third trimester or worry about it with your infant is pretty important. So, yeah, you should share that with our units, so that's an option. Performance eval, or sorry, any other announcements that people want on the record that we haven't covered? Oh, yeah, sorry.
I just wanted to remind everyone that presentations are being done for the Vice Chancellor's research position that kind of came out at the 12th hour last week. Nettie LaBelle Hammer did hers, and an announcement came out just like 4 or 5 hours before she did it. But I think now that things are moving along, there should be a couple, she may have more information. There should be 2 more coming up, and I believe that those are public and open for anyone to attend.
Great. Yeah, there are 3 candidates total. Nettie LaBelle Hammer, who's currently the Associate Vice Chancellor for Research and Director of the Alaska Satellite Facility. Larry Hinson, who's currently the Interim Vice Chancellor for Research. And then Frank
Rack. And his Frank Rack's presentation is at 9:30 on the 11th, just Wednesday,
mm-hmm.
at Butterbridge 109. And Larry Hinsman's is sometime after that. Friday the 13th at 10 a.m.
Great. Yep. Thank you, guys. That's an important one. Performance eval, we talked about this briefly in pre-staff. We really want to focus on communicating the value of performance evaluations. I asked this committee to exist and then never followed up with anyone, so that's still on my plate. Sorry about that. I think a lot of the issues will be fixed with the form that Brad came and talked to us about and with PageUp, but that still doesn't get the message across that these are important and why. So I think that'll be the real focus of that committee, is coming up with some good talking points. The external committee reports written, so those should be Brad, do you want to do a quick any update on the compensation committee besides what I mentioned earlier?
No, but if anyone has questions about compensation, master planning, or the Fresh Air Campus Committee, I'll take it.
And Leslie notes that Staff Healthcare Committee is going to meet on the 20th, so if you have any issues that you'd like our reps to bring up, then just let them know, and they can get the answers. All right. So I think we are ready for our roundtable discussion, if we can turn off the recording.